Hello and welcome to episode 162 of the Film Yak podcast. I'm John.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm JR.
This week we're talking JR's pick. That's right, JR's back.
What?
He never left. we never did an episode without him like we were supposed to. But we're talking about JR's pick, Memory, from Michelle Franco. Now, I really thought, JR, when you picked this movie, I was like, hey, this is great. Another 2024 movie I can knock off the list. And it's not. It's from fucking last year. Why would you choose this? What a nightmare.
I mean, I'll get into why I chose it.
Yeah, it's a 2023 release from Michelle Franco, starring Jessica Chastain, Peter Sarsgaard, Merritt Weaver, Elsie Fisher, and others.
Jessica Josh Charles? Got it. Come on.
Josh Charles?
Isn't that his name?
Yeah,
I don't know who that is.
He's on like some like.
He's like a Law and Order guy, right? Or something like Law and Order.
Said he was on Dead Poets Society, according to Letterboxd here.
Yeah, he's on that, but he's also on like some like.
He's
sitcom some, like, or like. Some.
Sports Night or. The Good Wife.
Oh, he was Sports Night.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And he's on The Good Wife as Will Gardner.
Okay. And, you know, we call that a Law & Order type show, right?
I
mean, pretty much.
I don't really know what The Good Wife is, so yeah, I guess.
It was
law.
She's
law
the lawyer.
Thing?
Yeah, The Good Wife is the lawyer.
Aren't
she
all,
gets divorced.
Aren't all shows that are like CBS shows, dramas, like, aren't they all about lawyers or cops?
I think so.
Or
I think
surgeons.
There are, yeah, I was going to say maybe they're doctors. I think they're canceling, like, this season of Blue Bloods is the last one.
Ooh. Poor Steve Sciarrippa. He'll have no career after this.
I don't even know who that is.
He's from Sopranos. He got picked up to be on that show, and he's been on it for 140 episodes. That's all he does.
Wow.
Well, it's amazing. That's what a lot of those guys, that's all they do. But,
sure.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm sure they're very, very rich from it, so I'm sure it doesn't matter at all that they're canceling it. But
I mean, yeah, I think it matters more for just like the 60-year-olds in our life.
Yeah.
Sure. Because that's, you know, I go tell my brother, hey, they're canceling Blue Bloods. He's not going to care. But then I'm like, well, this really affects our mother's life. She's seen every episode.
Yeah. My mom might watch that too. I don't even know. But my mom's a Longmire person.
You know? My dad's like not into anything. He just has stuff on.
Right. That's my
dad. Like Longmire was one of those. But mostly it's like Andy Griffith. So
my dad watches Gunsmoke like pretty much 24 hours a day. Like they wake up in the morning, they just turn on the there's like a Western station on Sling. And they just turn it on and they just leave it on Gunsmoke all day.
Don't they, like, have real Westerns on that channel ever?
No, it's just Western television.
I've never seen Gunsmoke.
Yeah.
It's like the No, I mean, they don't have movies. It's just a TV show. It's like the Gunsmoke and the Virginian and Bonanza and shit like that.
And the Rifleman.
Yeah, the Rifleman, they love that.
Mm.
So, yeah. Anyway. So some big stuff has happened since the last time we recorded. Namely, I guess the situation that happened at Comic-Con a few days ago, where I want to tell you guys, okay, this whole, like, Robert Downey Jr. was cast as Doctor Doom, right? This is the thing, and this is because. What's his face got canceled and fired? Jonathan Majors, right? He was going to be Kang the Conqueror, and he was going to be like on all the different Avengers movies and stuff.
The casting of Doctor Doom was going to happen,
sure,
because anyway. Avengers Secret Wars was planned,
right?
And they got a Fantastic Four movie, and maybe he's not the bad guy,
he was going to be Kang. Soon. Right? With this Doctor Doom? Okay, right.
Yeah.
Like, he's the big
bad. There
was going
to be a Kang Avengers movie, and now there will not be.
Right.
But Doctor Doom was coming.
Of course.
Yeah,
I don't know if it was going to come quite like this, though.
Yeah.
Well, I thought this was a joke when I saw the unveiling at Cinema or at CinemaCon at Comic-Con, and like he took off the mask and it was like, I thought this is like a meme, like they're making fun of this. They're saying, aha, Robert Downey Jr. is coming back. We've cast Robert Downey Jr. Like, because that's how silly it seems to me that you would take this fellow who you built the entire franchise on as one character and then suddenly just recast him as a different character. And I'm like, I have questions like, is Tony Stark Dr. Doom? Are they going to make that connection, or is there going to be zero connection?
I think it'd be insane to not make any connection. It'd be yeah, weird if the characters like see Dr. Doom and don't think he looks like Tony
Unless
Stark,
he's
right?
Gonna be a bunch of makeup and like CG and shit, which, you know, it's certainly possible.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Maybe you'll never see his face. Do you see Dr. Doom's face in the comics? I mean, you have to, right? At some point, right?
At some point. Probably, not yeah, usually.
Let me Google Dr. Doom's face.
I don't know. I don't know how to feel. I don't, you know, and I think it'd be a stretch to say that any of us are like gonna care a ton about this.
No, I don't care.
It's a curiosity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I think there's a world in which the billionaire who's an arms dealer, like in a multiverse, another universe, that guy goes bad. Like, that's not too much of a stretch.
Yeah,
like Iron Man's already a bad guy until they decide he's not, until he gets, you know,
yeah,
other heroes with him.
Sharing Dr. Doom's face in the chat.
I see.
Okay. A little bit of a grotesquerie there. All right, cool.
Mm.
Like a Phantom of the Opera kind of thing, maybe?
I mean, it's really kind of like a... I think that's like a Deadpool thing. Let's have it be Robert Downey Jr.'s voice, and when he takes his mask off, it's Ryan Reynolds in his Deadpool makeup.
Yeah.
Just fuck with people all over the place.
I mean, it's going to be a situation just like... He probably only took it because they were like, you know how little time you spent in the Iron Man suit? Even less time as Dr. Doom. Like, you'll barely be in the... You'll just come on a soundstage or come into a sound studio, record your lines, and then we're going to have another actor, you know, Mandalorian style.
You're probably right. There was some reporting, like, on the... how much he's being rumored to be making off this.
Was there?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure they're giving him, you know, like a couple of truckloads of money.
The rumor was north of $80 million for the two Avengers movies.
Okay. And I saw a report that said $500 million for everything. For everything that he's done with Marvel so far. He's made $500 million, they say.
Maybe. I'm guessing that he is negotiating some like the back end box office.
I'm sure he has points on probably multiple of those films, honestly.
Yeah, I mean. After that initial first Iron Man contract, I'm guessing he cashed in.
Big time.
And then he cashed out, and now he's cashing back in. But apparently he's also the one who said, bring the Russos back. I'll come back if the Russos come back. And, you know, those Russos, they've been really busy with the Gray Man.
Yeah.
I guess we're going to have to wait for the Gray Man 2 and Citadel Season 2.
Bummer.
Sorry, guys. Their like $300 million plus movies are just doing super well. Yeah, I don't know.
Again, though, it just feels like it's similar to the cast, getting Hugh Jackman in this Deadpool movie. It's just like Disney is on a downward trend. Not Disney, but Marvel's on a downward trend. I mean, Disney to a large extent is, but Marvel's on a downward trend. And like critically and commercially. And so they're like, okay, well, what's worked in the past? Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. Definitely. It's worked in the past. Robert Downey Jr. has worked in the past. Let's get him back in. The Russo brothers have worked in the past. Let's get him back, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, and I, yeah.
What doesn't work? Women. Women don't work. Stop making movies about women, right? This is what they've learned, so.
They yeah, have. And you know the...
Yeah.
That anti-woke mob, they're going to be like, we win. It's like, all right, good for you guys.
Yeah.
Get the Marvels out of there.
They should have just left Jonathan Majors in with that mindset, you know? let him just beat down the women characters in the movie. The fans would love that.
He had a quote today. Like,
I saw that. His Jonathan reaction. Jonathan Majors
is out here talking. Don't talk right now, man.
They invited him to some. He was at some big African American award ceremony recently. It might have been the BET Awards or something like that. They invited him to that, and I was like, "That's pretty wild that they would."
I'm not saying we can't invite him to anything.
I'm just saying
he's maybe not a great guy or not a good guy. He sounds like he's probably a really bad guy.
Normally, when people are canceled, they're not invited to big televised award shows. You know, that's all.
Yeah.
You know?
And I don't know.
Even Armie Hammer's making a comeback. You know, he was on Bill Maher's thing not that long ago.
That's not a Armie Hammer. The Hawksua girl was on Bill Maher's show. I mean, that's not a.
and Armie Hammer was canceled for like the weirdest. Like Armie Hammer was canceled because there was a joke that he's a cannibal, and then someone decided to make a whole documentary about that, and then like there's other stuff came out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The Armie Hammer stuff was just weird.
I agree.
But the Jonathan Majors thing, right? It's cool that Robert Downey Jr. gets to like get his redemption through the screen. I didn't really get that chance, and it's like it's a little fresh. It's a little fresher.
It's not for really a huge on the majors. I don't remember. Robert Downey Jr. was a drug addict, right? Did he hit a woman? I don't know. Did he hit women?
No. But I don't. So. Not that we know of. He had like a legal trouble thing. But
for having drugs, right?
Yeah, it was drug related. Not hitting people.
Yeah.
Oh, this is what it is. He was at, so I take it back. It wasn't an African American thing. It was a the Perseverance Awards. He appeared at Hollywood Unlocked Impact Awards, and he accepted the Perseverance Award.
What?
Yeah, dude. This is in June. This just like a month ago. As a black man in the criminal justice system, I felt anger. I felt sadness, hurt, surprise when they snatched me up out of my apartment in handcuffs. I didn't feel like all that.
It's rough because he was found guilty.
He was convicted of reckless assault, third degree, and harassment, misdemeanor, and a violation. Yeah.
So that just sounds bad. I don't like cops either.
Me neither. But you know, it's I don't like people who hit women either. It's pretty rough. Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to.
Mm.
Oh well, he'll have those residuals coming in for the rest of his life. He'll be fine. Just like Armie Hammer. Armie Hammer has residuals for the rest of his life. They don't take those away when you get canceled.
I know. He ended up being in like the not the most profitable Marvel movie.
Yeah, but he was in Creed 3, bro.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sorry. He did more things than Marvel. You're right.
He was in that Lovecraft Country on HBO also.
Yeah, yeah.
Hmm?
And Armie Hammer was in a lot of profitable movies.
Yeah.
Or a lot of big movies that have become... Not big movies. Big budget movies where he got probably paid a lot. And they're, you know, he's getting a cut of every DVD sale or stream at this point, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he'll be fine.
Yeah, and he's got his timeshare business, so he'll be fine.
They say that he told I think he was on Piers Morgan, and he told Piers Morgan that he can't get a job as an acting teacher. He tried to like apply to be an acting teacher at some college, and they wouldn't let him work there.
Mm.
So he's done. He's done, bud.
Yeah.
Armie Hammer?
Yeah, that was Armie
Hammer. I thought Armie Hammer was back.
No. God, no.
I thought he had a job.
Oh, he might have lined up a job, but I mean, that's like saying, you know, James Franco's back because he lined up a job.
Yeah,
I forgot
about James.
Yeah.
I didn't hear about lining up a job even. What did he get?
I don't know. Now I'm...
Death on the Nile, last thing on his Wikipedia.
Yeah, maybe I made this up.
I mean, I'm not saying... I don't doubt that he could get work again, especially in like smaller films, European stuff. They don't seem to give a shit about anything over in Europe. So.
Woody Allen is still directing over there?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Death on the Nile is his last credit on IMDb also. I don't know. I don't want to buy pro.
Yeah.
What was that? Oh, that's your cat. Like, what the
hell is that?
Yeah. Okay. It's Kevin's kids.
Yeah. It's Sebastian.
What's going on, Stephen?
What is this?
What is this?
It's Kev's friends.
Yeah, it's my podcast.
Hello.
Who's that one?
This is my friend JR.
Hey. And that, let me guess, John?
Yeah, you know John.
Oh, me.
That's Amelia's dad.
Can't hear me. Oh, yeah. Why does my face look weird?
What is, what?
There's rainbow barnacles all over my face.
I don't know. It's just very, yeah, it's very grainy.
Hold that thought. Oh, look, Mom is home. She is!
All right. Silly pants.
All right.
Have you seen what happens to your head?
Yes, they have.
Okay.
Okay.
Mommy!
You guys want to get into memory then?
Yeah, sure.
So, JR picked memory, the Michelle Franco drama, starring Jessica Chastain and Peter Sarsgaard. JR, why this movie? Why now?
Oh, well, I needed to pick something. So I was just kind of going through my watch list. And this came up, and you know, I knew that Franco had directed it. I knew, based on one other movie, that Franco seems to take a sort of maybe like banal or bland plot and zhuzh it up and put some really interesting characters in it, as he did with that movie that we liked,
Sundown.
Thank you, with Tim Roth.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty cool. And I had just finished Presumed Innocent on Apple TV Plus. I've been mostly watching TV like with Sarah late at night, you know, and we're just kind of, you know, enjoying stuff like Presumed Innocent.
Yeah, I hear you.
I was up and down on the series, but I was up the whole time on Tommy Malto, who is a really unlikable sleazebag lawyer played by Peter Sarsgaard. 10 out of 10 performance. Loved it. Loved him.
Nice.
In the hero, my hero of the show, not the actual hero of the show. And so I was like, you know what? We get a little bit more Sarsgaard action. I wouldn't mind that. So I picked this, and I knew only that it was a movie that kind of dealt with some trauma and a person who goes to AA meetings. And that person is Jessica Chastain. And yeah, Jessica Chastain is followed home. Just really loud for you guys.
Not to me.
Kind of is for me. It sounded like you were cutting out a little bit.
I was cutting out?
Yeah.
All right, sorry.
Oh boy.
So this person who it is very clear very early has some trauma. She's played by Jessica Chastain, and like her only social interaction seems to be hanging out with her sister. She goes to her sister's high school reunion for some reason. Because she's convinced to. She's clearly not having any fun. And while most people are dancing, she's sitting at a table. We get this great shot where an out-of-focus Peter Sarsgaard just, like, walks into the frame. And you see him, like, turn his head and look toward Chastain and just holds there for a little bit. And then he sits next to her. Seemingly says nothing. She gets up and leaves. And Sarsgaard follows her all the way home, sort of at a distance. It's unsettling. It's creepy.
About 30 feet.
Yeah. And he just like stands outside of her apartment all night. And I thought that was a bizarre way to start a movie. And I was like, man, did I pick the right movie for getting some more unlikable, creepy Peter Sarsgaard?
You thought that in the moment?
Yes, because I was still thinking about Presumed Innocent.
Right.
And I didn't, at that point, you do not know why he has done this. You do not know what is going on with him, or at least I did not know, because I did not read a detailed plot synopsis.
I made a mistake and watched the trailer before this, so I knew a little bit of what was happening.
I knew nothing going into it.
That's probably the smartest way to do it.
And yeah, this this guy, Peter Sarsgaard, as we find out the next day when he's picked up by his brother, the aforementioned Josh Charles, this guy's got early onset dementia, really bad memory issues, seemingly will get kind of lost at any given moment and not know what is going on. We see him like holding a notebook so he can write things down. And Jessica Chastain makes it a point to like, and she initiates another conversation after this very strange interaction where she was clearly very, and she goes to Josh Charles and Sarsgaard so she can talk to him, find out what he wanted, and to also accuse him of raping her. She was 12. Found the trauma. This is why I've just seen.
You're cutting out now, man. You're cutting out. What's going on? Are you hearing this, Kevin? Is he cutting out for you? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Get close to that mic, bud.
All I'm getting loud ambient sounds from one of you guys, and that's all I hear.
Oh, really? You know what? That's totally from me. Sorry.
So, at the point where Jessica Chastain in a park accuses Peter Sarsgaard of like sexually abusing her when she was 12 and he was 18, were you guys like, how is this going to be a movie with these two characters? How are they like the poster going to end up in the tub together? Like, how do you come back from this? What the fuck?
I was thinking to myself, I was like, okay, how are we going? The director is now going to expect us to like empathize and sympathize with a rapist, you know, and like we're supposed like a child rapist, and we're supposed to like, and it's like, is that the sort of point of the movie? It's like, can we feel sympathy for this man? Is this man human anymore? Because he's losing his mind. So it's, is that any sort of excuse to like feel bad for him or something? I was like, that could be really interesting. And I was like, it's almost, it feels like it'd be impossible to do, but it'll be interesting. Yeah. The attempt, you know?
Ooh, man. And of course he has no memory of this. And we don't know if like, is that like, you legitimately don't have memory of this? Is that
exactly
selective? You have either you are lying or you have chosen to forget like this awful thing that you did in your youth. And I was real nervous. And then, and she just like leaves him in the park, takes the little necklace that his daughter,
his emergency contact info,
was giving him, giving like the beads where like to say like, I have dementia and like call this number. She fucking takes it and just walks off.
She told him, you deserve to be like this.
Yeah.
Which is true. Yeah. If like, I can miserate with that feeling if she's right.
Mm.
And what's interesting about the accusation, and one of my big sort of gripes with the movie, is that she's not remembering that correctly, which is that's good. Like, that's thematically interesting, you know, that she has a false memory of something and that he can't remember anything.
Well, I agree. I went through this like same thing, right? Like, it's not just his memory, it is her memory. And I was wondering, like, I assume that this did happen to her, although that actually gets complicated at the very end too, where then I don't know anymore. In the moment, as I'm watching this, I'm like, she probably was abused in this way, forced to give these like older high school kids blowjobs when they're hanging out when she's 12. And she's like, because of the moment at the high school reunion where Sarsgaard sits down and then follows her, she has like kind of implanted him into this memory, as though like, because she names this other guy, like Brian or something.
Ben.
Ben, thank you. She names Ben, and like there's there are these other friends, and I wonder if she just like filled in with some younger version of Sarsgaard's face.
Well, she knows that she asks Sarsgaard, "Do you remember Ben so and so?" And he says, "Yes." Yeah. So like, he knows him. He knows the guy who did this altar.
Well, because
so, like,
she
probably did see him. She probably did see him back then. And like you're saying, she's conflating, you know, a big group of friends. He was a part of the group of the friends. He must have been one of them.
But we learn that he could not have.
Oh, right. Because he just came.
He like transferred after Sylvia had transferred away.
Right.
To go to a different school.
Oh, that's right. Mm. She had left. Yeah, that's right. So she couldn't have even seen his face. But I think, okay, yeah, but you're right. Okay, yeah, that's a good point. And she would have already decided that he had assaulted her before she asked him if he knew Ben, right?
I think she had.
Yeah.
I think she had decided it. I think she had spent that sleepless night with him outside kind of making some decisions about who this could be and why he was following her. I think. I don't know. We're not given a full answer on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, Kevin.
Well, I was going to, I don't know, even though it's only been like 2 days, like, I don't remember how much, if any, they got into this, you know, in the movie, but like people who have been, like, people who have been abused, you know, suffer, you know, obviously they're going to have, you know, some PTSD, and because of that, they're inherently going to have memory problems.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's not, I don't know if they actually say that ever, but that's, you know, sort of just implied, right? I mean, you don't ever know. As soon as it's revealed that she's wrong about him, then it's like, you know, you don't know what her credibility is. And she was, and she's admittedly, she was drunk the whole time, you know, she was an alcoholic as a child. So then it's like, who knows what's. And her mother constantly saying she makes up stuff all the time, you know, and because she probably did. She probably lied to her mother a lot, you know, when she was trying to get away with things as a teen alcoholic. But that doesn't mean that her abuse is made up, you know.
Yeah. And then
the
mother is. If this movie wanted like full ambiguity, you know, for the majority of it on whether or not there was ever trauma in Sylvia's past, I think the mom kind of ruins that. Not that she's bad, but like,
yeah,
she's just kind of like bitchy enough that you assume that she sucks.
Yeah. I mean, the mom is definitely like talk about unlikable. The mom is like from the beginning, like presented as, you know, like they're going, like she picks up, the sister in like, you know, a chauffeured car and, you know, like, you know, got you these presents and, you know, like very, like you very much believe, you know, can see that like, okay, obviously they're a very well-to-do family. So obviously if this happens, like they're going to say that it's a lie and they're going to try to hush it up and, you know, just endless gaslighting, endless.
I love that she also like immediately complains in that car scene about where Sylvia lives. And like it's like a looks like a dump. And I do love the way that the production team decided to like remind us that this is a dump by just having a wall of tires outside of the front door. It's like to work next to like a
car repair. To be fair, I mean, if like the inside of the apartment looks fine.
Oh yeah, it does.
Yeah, yeah. It's like that does seem like that apartment's probably like $3,500 a month. You know what I mean? Like that's probably a really expensive more, fucking apartment. Yeah. And so it's like, I get the feeling that like, that's a relatively nice apartment. It's just, you know, that's what you get in New York. You're not going to live unless you live in a brownstone, you know, you're going to live in a place next to a mechanic or something, you know, it's like,
yeah.
And with a door that has graffiti on it that you don't know what it is. And then it's like, oh, it's, you know, to hide it from being robbed. But anyway, I felt like there was a real, like James Gray feel to this movie. Did you guys get this?
felt not very familiar James enough with his work to Gray-ish? Be able to say.
Oh, really?
Jim? Yeah, not
James Gray.
I certainly did not think
really?
That.
Wow. Watching,
I want to hear this out.
It just felt I don't know, like just I guess the way he frames things and color palette and probably a lot of it just has to do with the fact that it's about New Yorkers and different classes of New Yorkers. And you've got this sort of like, you know, upper middle class, well, upper class, I guess. And then mixed with her situation. I don't know. The whole thing just, and like those shots of the train, it just reminded me of like Two Lovers a lot, I guess, you know.
It's a lot of relationships that others don't approve of.
Right. Stuff like that. Yeah. I don't know. There wasn't a, you know, an ethnic element to it or anything, but it's like, yeah, I don't know. Just felt like, just reminded me of James Gray. Hmm. Maybe a cinematography feel too. Like, I don't know who the cinematographer was on this, but Ives Cape, who did Holy Motors.
Oh, wow.
And, White Material and Sundown. Indeed.
I mean, I've gone through the setup, which, you know, is big. And I guess we should mention that after this interaction, and Sylvia is told by her sister, played by Mara Weaver, that you could not have known this boy. Mm-hmm. Like, he could not have raped you. You are wrong about this. She's also offered a job by Sarsgaard's family. The niece, played by Elsie Fitcher from eighth grade. She's like
from Texas Chainsaw, but sure.
That's good. She's like, it seems like my uncle really gets along with you. Do you want to like be his babysitter while I'm away at college? Which is like, and that's a lot of trust on this random woman. And of course, she, not yet knowing that this man could not have raped her, is like, no. But then does it. She finds out and she's like, I'll try it out. And a relationship slowly, but then definitely kicks off. And that's a bizarre relationship that people in the film have a lot of feelings about.
Now, when they do consummate that relationship, which I feel like is pretty late in the film. I mean, they don't actually like fuck for a while, right? But when they finally fuck, did it ever cross either one of your minds that maybe suddenly it would like awaken a memory in him? Oh my God, I did rape this girl. And like a trauma memory comes back, you know, or for either one of them, you know what I mean?
Well, I could see that she was extremely uncomfortable.
Like they both seem awkward as fuck during that scene. But yeah, I mean, I feel like sure. It's just like, because she probably hasn't had sex in forever. He probably hasn't had sex in forever. Yeah. They just don't, you know what I mean?
Well, you see more, you see her face because, you know, you're just seeing the back of Sarsgaard's head, but you're seeing her kind of grimace the entire time. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, really uncomfortable here.
I mean, it would be like one of her first lines is, I asked for a repair woman. When a guy shows up to fix the refrigerator, I think if she was not uncomfortable, that would have been weird.
Yeah.
Well, that's just classic. I mean, if you're a man. No, see, I didn't read that like that at all. I mean, in retrospect, I could see that reading, but like, it's also like, how much of that is just, I'm a single woman in New York City. Like, obviously I don't want some strange fucking man coming into my apartment in the middle of the day when I'm alone.
Yeah.
I mean, or with my daughter, you know, like you're not going to want strange people in your house.
I guess you're right. I thought that was a line put in there to make sure we knew men are not around.
I agree. Like, I think that's part of it, but I think there's also some of it that's just like
practical,
you know? Yeah. And it's happened so early in the film that maybe it's there as like a, you don't know if it's just practical or not because you don't really know her yet that much.
Yeah.
And what she's been through. Also, okay, so real quick. So is this okay that they have sex?
So, and this is, I did not go to the trauma stuff. I kind of went to that.
Right.
It's like, Sarsgaard seems to remember her just fine. Like, I guess something is imprinted enough on his brain. Like, he knows who she is.
Sure.
But I was definitely thinking, like, for Sylvia, and it's weird, I'm calling Chastain's character by her name every time and calling Sarsgaard every time. Sorry.
Sarsgaard is Saul.
Yeah, Saul.
Or if you're a character in the movie, it's Sal, because nobody can pronounce Saul for some reason. You guys notice this? Everyone calls him Sal for the whole fucking movie. It's like his name is Saul. He says Saul.
Did you think that was an accent problem?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it was obviously, it's not like a purposeful. They probably think they're saying Saul, and they're just coming out sounding like Sal. Maybe it's a problem with me. Maybe I'm just hearing it that way. But I swear to God, it's like 80% of the time they said it, I was like, his name's not Sal. You got to stop.
Anyway, I definitely like went into like a questioning mode. It's like, how much of this relationship for Sylvia is like predicated on Saul not being like a fully present human? Saul kind of seeming like someone who does not have the ability to hurt her.
And does not have the ability to consent to sex. And also might think that she is his ex-wife or his dead wife.
It's a lot.
For sure.
Is it ethical? Is it rape? Is he diminished? These are all questions I had.
I don't know. I don't know where I land on that.
I
know where Josh Charles lands on it.
Oh, yeah. Right. He's hard against it.
But this is the problem that I have with the movies, that they don't interrogate that idea at all. It's like that's interesting. The same thing with like her memory, like how she doesn't remember things, like that's interesting too. And they just like sort of breeze over it, like, oh, she was wrong about that. So now there's a path for them to get together, and they get together. And I mean, I think it's like sort of I hesitate to call it sweet, but it's like, I like the ending. Like, I like that they get together, and I like how it's like a sweet moment, but it's also like a weird and awkward moment, and like kind of gross in a lot of ways. Yeah. So I, you know, these are like damaged individuals who, I don't know that they should be with each other. I don't know that they should be in the same room even, you know?
Yeah, they definitely should not. And it does seem like, you know, after maybe an hour, yeah, this movie is definitely more interested in just kind of giving us the plot.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what these two people are doing. And stops asking or trying to answer most of the questions, kind of like you said. And it definitely becomes more about the mom, like, or the problems caused by the mom, all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's like Saul is no longer a problem. The problem is the mom.
Right.
Yeah. And I think once we finally get the sisters, you know, I don't know how you guys felt, but like the whole you're here, you know, yeah, but you defended a pedophile, and then you know, like then at, like all the stuff starts coming to a head, and it's like, oh, this kind of feels like it came out of nowhere, and then like, oh, so you know, a huge piece of the puzzle is, you know, dropped in our laps. And then apparently, you know, the sister is finally like, you know, no, like she's telling the truth. So now Chastain has more credibility, and you know, we have even more reasons to dislike the mother.
Mm-hmm. And that fucking husband, Merritt Weaver's husband, every time he opens his mouth, like, see you next Tuesday.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was a real prick. When you say she has more credibility, so we're buying it at the end there that this happened?
I think so.
With the dad?
Yeah. Or,
I mean,
yeah. Do you have reason to not? At that point, I feel like Merritt Weaver, it's like she's supposed to be the the third party that you can trust, because she does not stand to gain anything in that moment. Like, she wants a relationship with her mother,
right,
and her sister.
Yeah, I guess I'm not like assuming that she's lying or that, and I like that scene. It's one of my favorite scenes in the movie because it was the only part where like emotions really worked for me, because I didn't find the relationship emotional that much, but that scene was very mm-hmm. emotional. And I don't know. It just feels like it was back and forth a lot in that moment. And I guess I wasn't like 100% sure in the moment, but talking about the third party perspective. That's true. I didn't think about that, but
I'm deciding that was true. Maybe that just makes it cleaner. Because I also really liked Jessica Harper, the mother, in this scene. Mm-hmm. I love like how after Merritt Weaver kind of says her piece, that she like looks at Chastain, at Sylvia, and is like thinking about crying, thinking about maybe like hugging her daughter. But as she gets closer, Chastain just like yells like, "Don't touch me." And that like instant, just like that like shitty kid parent response, like where you just like your kid says something and you just like freak out. She's like, "He never touched you."
Right. Yeah.
Just like, even if she knows that's not true, she just like has sort of this like habitual response to her kid that she's decided has always been lying. I thought it was like a very human moment built on real relationships, that if you have like a kid who yells at you, that felt very real.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah. Go ahead.
So how familiar were you guys with Procol Harum before this movie?
The song, Martin Scorsese owns the song, I should say, from his segment in New York Stories, where this song was very, very prominent.
Oh.
Okay. But aside from that, yeah, I mean, I know who Procol Harum is, yeah. Okay. it's a huge song, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's just, you know, it becomes like the song, you know, like it's a big thing in the middle of the movie, and then they're playing it over the credits. So it's like, you know, there was a documentary that about like progressive rock, and like I remember they were trying to like put up Wider Shade of Pale as like kind of the first prog rock song, which I have problems with, but you know, I mean, it's not a bad song, but it's like,
I don't understand why it's prog at all, but
yeah, I mean, like if we're getting hard line, you know, hard line here, like, you know, probably the Beatles, I have to say. Yeah.
Well, certainly before Whiter Shade of Pale. They're watching Basquiat, a former deep dive on this very show at one point in the movie, which is weird.
Well, but he doesn't understand films.
Right. And she's crying. She's crying at Basquiat, which I thought was weird because Basquiat wasn't very good and did not make me cry. But but obviously Franco's a fan of it, you know, so that's fine.
Well, he would be, wouldn't he?
I guess. Would he?
I don't know. Artsy fartsy people.
That's true. Yeah, maybe.
Into the artsy fartsy movies. I mean,
I feel like I'm kind of artsy fartsy and I didn't like it. So.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Like there's. You know, I mean, there's people who are more artsy and
sure,
and then there's people who are more fartsy,
right? It's true. All right, true. I'm out of notes. Ratings.
I'm going 3.
I'm also a 3.
Guess it only matters if John's out of notes. Okay.
I am the host. Got to keep her moving, JR.
Do you guys think Saul just like jumped off the balcony?
What?
At the end when he ends up in the hospital, he just like unlocks the window in the kitchen apartment, walks onto the balcony, and then Sylvia gets a phone call that Saul's in the hospital.
I didn't get that he hurt himself though. I got that he was in the hospital because it was like cold out and he was walking around naked.
Okay, well, he wasn't naked, was he?
He was in his boxers. Was he naked?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't have a shirt for sure.
Yeah.
He didn't have any pants for sure. Yeah. Mm. I don't know. Maybe. I mean, did they show him with a injury after?
I don't think so. That's what I was like. Okay, that makes more sense.
I think he's in the hospital more as like the police found him and they brought him to the hospital to make sure he was okay. Not that he was actually injured at all, you know?
Well, I mean, I do think JR raises an interesting question because like it would be like, I think it would be a feasible idea because, you know, like say like he, you know, is having like all of a sudden he gets like a very like lucid moment. Like he knows who he is and he knows what's wrong with him. And he like, you know, I don't know how old Sarsgaard is or how old his character is. I'm guessing, you know, like mid-40s, but like that could have all like hit him at once. And then, you know, decided to end it. Cause like I've been reading, one of Terry Pratchett's books, and he was a big proponent of, you know, like choosing, like you should be able to choose when you die, and like it was a big deal for him because like he had like severe like Alzheimer's towards the end of his life, and he wanted to go the Godard route before it like really got super bad. So
I'm holding my reading hostage. I have one more question.
Go ahead.
So I mentioned this kind of at the beginning. In my opinion, it's like she's right about her mother and her father abusing her. She's wrong about Saul. Do we think the entire like abuse in high school was something made up to kind of like just keep pushing this idea of abuse on her mother? She's like, try to get her mom to accept some truth. Or was it that this horribly unfortunate child just found herself in another abusive situation?
I mean, it makes sense for someone who is abused at home to be abused in other places.
Yes.
If she was, you know, like we know that she's a recovering, you know, addict. So, and yeah, like that kind of thing does happen to people who are in those situations. So
it's like John is ultimately right that like the title and ideas brought up at the beginning of the movie introduce these things and just lets them hang there without interrogating them. And that is frustrating, but I guess we'll just never
know. What my answer to your question would be, I think it probably did happen, but it doesn't matter. It's like it's completely irrelevant to what happens in the film at all.
Yeah.
You know, because what ends up being important is the abuse she suffered when she was even younger at the hands of her father. Yep. That's the important abuse. The abuse in high school is just a byproduct of that abuse, right? If it happened, it's a byproduct of the fact that she became an alcoholic, probably large part due to the fact that she was abused. So,
good point.
But yeah, what's your rating?
3.5.
3.5. All
right.
Yeah, I'm gonna go. Yeah. Slightly higher, impressed by all the performances in this film. And, you know, I'm not as I've been told, I'm not an actor's guy. I do want to give props to Sarsgaard.
You've tried so hard to fight against that in certain reviews. I remember specifically in the Straight Time review, you were praising Dustin Hoffman so much. It's a great performance, and I just really like it. No, I agree. The performances are good. The only reason it's a 3 for me is because of the aforementioned issues, you know,
absolutely
thematic stuff. But okay, so we're going to do Are we doing Letterboxd Roulette, right, with this thing? Because we Jessica Chastain, Sarsgaard, Merritt Weaver, Josh Charles, Elsie Fisher, and Jessica Harper, I think, are all well-known enough and have done enough stuff. So it's going to be Chastain. Fuck. I was really hoping it was going to be...
Josh Charles.
No, Weaver. I think I have you guys beat on Weaver, but... Chastain. Yeah, I'm done on Chastain. It's
same.
It's
a joke.
You made it through the whole, you made it through the whole damn thing without mentioning how much you hate her, and that's
great. Okay, yeah, fair enough. I've had issues with her in the past, and I don't know, maybe it's the amount of time it's been since I've seen a big Jessica Chastain movie. Like, I didn't watch Tammy Faye or The Good Nurse or Scenes from a Marriage. I didn't watch any of this shit, so maybe I just had enough time away from her. I thought she was very, very good in this, and not awful like she has been in the past and other things. So, didn't hate her.
That's great. That's great news.
Yeah.
And that's good. I don't think Tammy Faye would have
helped. I know it would have been an epic... push in the other direction.
Indeed.
I have 9 for Merritt Weaver, by the way.
I have, I think I had 7, so I guess you would have beaten me with her too, but yeah, I had 7. You've seen Marwin, haven't you?
I have not.
Oh, yeah?
Not seen Marwin.
I haven't seen Signs or Michael Clayton, so that's probably the two.
That is definitely the two.
Well, anyways, I've got 11 for Chastain. I'm sure Jer has 15,000, so.
It's more than 11, but not many more.
Kevin?
I got 5.
Wow.
Whoa. Yeah.
I have 17.
Of course. Not many more than 11, just 6 more.
Has Kevin seen...
Than half more.
I mean, you guys are Shakespeare guys. You guys haven't seen Coriolanus?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Coriolanus rules.
I've never seen. I didn't watch Coriolanus because Gerard Butler was in it, and then when I became a Shakespeare fan, it was because I didn't want to see it before I read it.
Right. All right. So, what am I watching?
Sorry, guys.
let's see. The list is our Crossing Cannons list, and the pick is number 1998. Would it be cool if it was a film from 1998?
That would be cool. Make it happen. Film
is a little movie called My Winnipeg. Have you seen this, Kevin?
I have not.
Oh, this is perfect for you.
I love Winnipeg
by Guy Madden.
Oh.
2007. This is a weird one.
I really do love this movie.
Yeah.
80 Jared minutes. It can't be too mad.
Yeah, you got it. You got this.
One of my favorite theater experiences at the Canal Place in New Orleans.
Oh, yeah. Canal Place. Britannia. It's called Britannia now, at Canal. But anyway. Sorry.
Britannia rules the waves.
All right. You're going to be watching My Winnipeg from 07 for the next episode. And that leads us right into what we watched. And I guess I can discuss the homework from last episode, which I had completely forgotten about until we were about to record 2 days ago. And then I beasted it out in the last minute. And it's Clueless from Amy Heckerling. From 1995, starring Alicia Silverstone, the It Girl of 1995. This is her big movie break, though, right?
I mean, it had to be, right?
Or was she in something before this that was big?
Just the Aerosmith video, right?
Right.
Mm.
Or was that, okay. I don't even know if that was before.
Probably. Anyway, this movie also stars a young Paul Rudd in, I guess, his first or second big movie, depending on what you think came out first or something. I don't know. There's a lot of debate about whether this or Halloween 6 is his first film. But anyways, and the late, great Brittany Murphy and Jeremy Sisto's in this, and Breckin Meyer, and a lot of other recognizable figures. Dan Hedaya just crushing it as Cher's father in this. Very, very funny. I've seen Clueless half a dozen times probably throughout my life. I like Clueless a lot. Very, very funny. Very watchable. Insanely watchable. No other film, I don't think, on that list would I have been able to crush out in the last 90 minutes before the show so easily as Clueless. So, yeah, I'm just a big fan. I don't know. It's based on Emma, apparently, the Jane Austen novel. I've never read it. I don't – never read any Jane Austen novels. I'm not opposed to it. Just haven't got around to them. And Heckerling also did Fast Times at Ridgemont High, right? So that's another one that I'm fond of. Although I haven't always liked Fast Times. It took a couple of watches to get around to that one. But but yeah, just a great, a little weird, obviously there's a lot of 90s shit going on in here, but like that kind of stuff doesn't bother me. It's just a product of its time, but they're like weird. It's weird how like all the students in this are reading like really heavy literature. And I don't know what the point of that is, like what the comment is. Like Paul Rudd's reading Nietzsche at one point, and then Jeremy Sisto's reading Junkie by William Burroughs at one point. And it's like, I don't, and then there's another character who Cher falls in love with, who's really into like 50s retro shit, which I know was like a big thing at the time, or like 40s even, or stuff like the, you know, the convertible coupes from the 40s and like Billie Holiday. And he loves Spartacus, which is weird because that's not even a 40s movie, but it's like, it's just weird. Like he's in, you know, he's into like really old, like classic stuff. And I don't know, I guess that was like a big thing. I feel like it, you know, maybe less so with teenagers. I don't know. But anyway.
So just like a way to sort of like jokingly give weight to these characters. I don't know. It's almost like silly it, that they're into this.
Yeah,
stuff.
I think it's mainly to make fun of them, right? It's like showing like how I think the Friedrich Nietzsche stuff, showing Paul Rudd reading Friedrich Nietzsche while wearing black sunglasses in all black by a pool in L.A. is like a funny image. It's like, oh, yeah. Look how depressed and sad this, and you know, this guy's a nihilist, but yet he's living in like the lap of luxury and doing just fine. So that one makes a little bit more sense, but I don't know. Anyway, it just reminded me of that MTV show, which was a remake of the BBC show Skins. I don't know if you guys remember Skins.
I've heard of it.
The BBC one had the guy from X-Men. He played Beast.
James McAvoy.
No. No.
Nicholas Holt.
Nicholas Holt. Yeah, Nicholas Holt.
Anyone there?
Okay. You hear us?
I disappeared for a second, I think.
Okay. Nicholas Holt is in Nicholas Skins. Holt.
And not James McAvoy.
I remember in the first episode of both the American and the British version, there's like a shot of Nicholas Holt's character in the British version, I don't know whoever plays him in the American, and they're reading Nausea by Jean-Paul Sartre. And I was just like, they're on the toilet reading it in the morning, like before they go to school. And I was like, what a absurd, ridiculous like thing. Like what kid is reading Nausea before he goes to school while he's taking a shit in the morning? But anyway, anyways, I like Clueless. Clueless is good. 3.5. Moving on. Alicia Silverstone having a bit of a resurgence lately, I feel like. She was in Killing of a Sacred Deer and then Reptile last year. And
Yeah,
she's been in some stuff.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Was it her in Blast from the Past?
Yes.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, sorry. I saw Brendan Fraser last night in a movie.
You saw him? Oh,
I was gonna say
he came over to your house.
No, I watched this this '90s movie with River Phoenix and Lily Taylor called Dogfight.
Yeah.
And I really liked it, but
Criterion.
It's yes, it's these Marines who throw a dogfight where they each like have to find the ugliest girl they can and get them to come to a party, and whoever finds the ugliest girl wins a cash prize. And of course, River Phoenix falls for the girl he brings, Lily Taylor. But there's a scene where these Marines are just like out about in town at an arcade, and they pick a fight with these Navy guys. And they had a really funny name for them that I didn't write down. The Navy guy who talks is a very young Brendan Fraser, who is like literally like shaking as he like seethes anger. It's he really like beat the odds becoming a decent actor, because he did not show it. in that one scene.
Did he become a decent actor though?
I don't know. We can't call him decent.
Competent stretches it even.
Fight too much.
I don't know.
Wow.
I disappeared again. I think
he.
You're fine, JR.
For me, I feel like something like Airheads. He's probably better than most things that he's in. Like something that requires very little. It's more comedic. He's probably like better in like George of the Jungle, even, or something like that. You know.
Well, but that's. I mean, I think that he is funny and fine.
Yeah.
In The Mummy. Like, that's a great place for Brendan Fraser.
The Mummy. Yeah, I think he's maybe.
I would agree.
I think he's maybe a notch above his pay grade in The Mummy. Maybe one notch. Okay. Just a little bit above him. And I don't.
He I'm did not deserve Rachel Weisz.
Well, no, he definitely doesn't deserve Rachel Weisz, but especially not, you know, 1999 Rachel Weisz. But no, I just feel like he's, you know, I mean, obviously, he's just not I don't know. Like, when did we decide that he's a good actor? I don't know. Because he's in The Whale? Because he put on a fat suit? I don't know.
Well, I mean, I thought The Whale was fucking terrible. I hate
it. I didn't think it was terrible, but it's certainly not like good, and he's not very good in it. So I don't know. I don't understand. But anyway, okay. Well, who wants to continue on what we watched?
I mean, I just did.
It's Kevin. Oh, sorry. Oh yeah, you just talked about that movie randomly. Yeah. Okay, that was weird.
Sorry.
He snuck one in there, Kevin. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was under the radar. Okay, so I rewatched As Good As It Gets with Jack Nicholson, Greg Kinnear, Cuba Gooding Jr., Helen Hunt, Shane Black.
Harold Ramis.
Tom.
Skeet Ulrich.
Yeah, but fuck him.
Who's the other guy from Scream who's in it?
Jamie Kennedy's
in.
Yeah, and the
Tom?
Guy from Frasier, Tom something.
Oh, Bulldog was in it.
No, not Bulldog. Kenny.
Oh, Ken, not Banya. Relax.
Yeah, that's Seinfeld. But
yeah, I don't remember his name. Tom something. You're right, but I don't remember.
Yeah,
he was in Heavyweights also. Yeah.
Yes.
What? Who's he? Who is he in the movie?
He's the maitre d', who's like, you know, you have to wear a tie and jacket and.
Oh really? See, I don't even remember that.
I got that scene in Dogfight too.
Oh nice.
Where he needs a tie and jacket to get into a restaurant.
We have a shitty maitre d', River Phoenix.
Did River go down the street and buy a tie and a jacket from the window of a shop?
Yes.
Yeah.
Did he refuse to go in the shop?
No.
Okay. See, not the same.
Yeah.
That's what my Letterboxd review was about.
Was it?
people being really shitty in restaurants.
Mm.
How my movie training tells me that like I need to be empathetic with the character, and like these hoity-toity restaurants are shitty and awful. And my service industry brain is like these guys are just doing a job. Like their job sucks.
Yeah.
Like River Phoenix is an 18-year-old Marine. He's not gonna fucking tip.
Yeah. He don't believe in it.
That's good.
Yeah,
I didn't even see that review. All right.
Sorry. Kevin.
Sorry. Continue. Yeah, please.
Yeah. So, As Good As It Gets, a movie that I watched when I was young enough to have zero business watching a movie like that. And it had been a long, long time since I had seen it. And JR? Oh,
JR left us.
Yeah.
That's okay. You want to just continue while he gets
back? Yeah, sure.
And he's back.
Yeah.
That was quick.
Yeah. Yeah, so had no business watching As Good As It Gets as young as I was, but I still really enjoy it. Like, Nicholson is just, you know, on fire. The reason it wasn't a five for me was because watching it now, like I felt like the back and forth between the comedy and the drama sometimes didn't work for me. And also, like, this you know, it started out as just a nitpick, but then I'm like, are you, like, y'all can't be serious. I didn't need to hear clearly the conversations of everyone around them. Like, all the, like, random, you know, like, people, like there's a scene where they're, like, you know, following, like, Helen Hunt and her mother, like, they're, like, walking into a restaurant, and you're hearing, like, 17 conversations as they're walking through.
Really?
It's like, I don't, yeah, it's like, I don't need, and it's, like, distinct. It's mm-hmm. not just, like, background noise, and it's, I, you know, I didn't need that.
So, interesting.
Yeah. But yeah, it's very, very good. And yeah. So,
oh. Yeah, I love it. Preaching to the choir, buddy. all right. JR, you want to talk, oh, never mind. Never mind. I was about to say, do you want to talk Deadpool and Wolverine? You didn't watch Deadpool and Wolverine, did you?
I did not, no.
Okay, I'll talk Deadpool and Wolverine. Sorry. I watched Deadpool and Wolverine in the theater.
And the third, the careful with spoilers, right? Like, Kevin, you like the Deadpool movies, haven't you?
It's it is fine if John spoils. No,
I'm not going to spoil anything. Listen, I would recommend you not go to the Letterboxd page because there's a lot of spoiling in the cast list, quite frankly. So be careful looking at that cast list on the Letterboxd page. But I will say, I did not dislike this movie. I haven't disliked any of the Deadpool movies. I thought the first one was actually quite funny, like, you know, pretty good overall. And the second one was less so, but this one is, you know, fine. It's just a lot. It's just, it's got like so much fan service in it, but I can't deny that like a lot of that fan service really works for me. I think it's like funny and, you know, entertaining to see old faces that you haven't seen in a long time back. And it's somewhat clever the way that they bring some of them back. Some of them more clever than others. Some of them are just feel like they're just show up out of nowhere for no reason. But, you know, there are, they deal with certain casting situations from the past in really interesting ways. And, I think it's funny. It's probably the least funny out of the three, and it's definitely trying to be funny a lot. And it's just not, I don't know, the whole Ryan Reynolds just riffing constantly, it gets a little old. And I don't find the dynamic between Deadpool and Wolverine to be comical at all. I understand why it should be or why people might think that that's funny, like a funny duo. But it doesn't work for me. Wolverine is not funny at all. Hugh Jackman is not funny at all. And he's... I don't want to say he's barely in it because he's in it. Like, Hugh Jackman's in this movie a lot. But... it feels like there's not a lot for him to do outside of like just, you know, murder people with his claws and be upset with Deadpool and how annoyed he is with him. I mean, there is an arc of his character, but it's sort of like lame and cliched, and you know exactly where it's going, like from the get go. So, and obviously I think a lot of it is the fact that Sean Levy is involved. And the fact that it's a Marvel film, I think, is a big problem, too. I think that's a lot of the reason that it's not maybe as punchingly funny as it's been in the past, because it's trying to appeal. And, I mean, I think that they think that they're being, like, really, like, whoa, can you believe in a Disney film they're doing this? Can you believe they let me just cut this guy's dick off in this Disney film? But it's, like, it's not that aggressive. Like, for some reason, I don't know, the first film feels way more aggressive than this. But, I mean, this movie is definitely very violent, but I don't know, big deal. I didn't dislike it. It's certainly, you know, fun to watch, and it's only 2 hours. It's not like a normal Marvel movie, which is 2 hours and 45 minutes. So that alone, it makes it somewhat worth it, I guess.
I think they've calmed down a little bit. Like, the Marvels were short.
Yeah, let's see that runtime on the next Avengers film. Then you tell me they calm down.
Oh yeah, no, I'm expecting the new Captain America to be quite long as well.
Yeah. Oh, that looks.
Brutal. You saw.
They showed that before the trailer for that before this movie.
Back to political thrillers.
Yikes, dude! Yikes. And I just don't, I'm sorry, but like this idea that we're going to hinge our, this name and this franchise that, you know, what's really important is Captain America. Nobody cares about the actor. We can have anybody play out. We can shift Captain America to different actors. I don't think that's going to work. I don't know that it's not going to work. Maybe people like the Falcon as much as they like Chris Evans. I doubt it. From the reaction in my theater to when Chris Evans shows up in Deadpool, and I won't say anything else about that, but when he shows up in Deadpool, it's not a spoiler. He's in Deadpool. It's in the cast list. I'm not going to say anything else. Believe me, it's not a spoiler. He shows up in Deadpool. It's like the people freak the fuck out when he showed up, you know? So you can imagine, you know, how, like, look how they reacted when Robert Downey Jr. showed up on the stage at Comic-Con. I don't think they'd react that way for that guy who plays Falcon, whatever his name. What's that guy's name? I'm sorry.
Anthony Mackie.
Yeah.
Louisiana guy.
Fuck him. I don't know anything about him. He's in Hurt Locker.
He was in 8 Mile. 20 years ago. He was the bad guy in 8 Mile.
Yikes.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen that.
Kevin, add it to your watch list. I add it to the deep dive list. I've never seen it either.
I don't want to. No, we're not doing that.
The Curtis Hanson film, man. I watched one of his movies the other day. Anyway, that's it for Deadpool and Wolverine.
This is not the film I thought you were going to ask me to talk about.
Well, there is another one I forgot, but I just it's later in my. I mean, actually, okay. It's next, but whatever.
I guess I'll do one of my recent releases. I watched Hundreds of Beavers, which is available on Hoopla, and this is it's like a partially animated movie. It's a bizarre movie. It's trying to be like a Looney Tunes style thing with this this like a fur trapper in old French Canada, trying to trap beavers, and it is extremely repetitive, and the repetition is part of the joke. Sometimes this is funny, like a lot of the beavers are just like people in big suits, like mascot suits. And it's just a lot of like silly gags. And at, you know, an hour, 48 minutes, it definitely overstays its welcome. But I think it is something that, like old animation fans should at least check out. Cause it is creative and very funny at points, even if the whole thing is too long.
You said it was on Hulu?
Hoopla, unfortunately.
Hoopla. Oh, okay. Well,
gotta have the right library account.
Yeah, I need to go over to Livingston and get a card from their parish.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. I'm a big fan of library fraud.
Indeed, as you should be.
Okay. All right. Kevin?
Okay. So I'll do two. So I finally got around to watching Herzog's Nosferatu the Vampire, which is his amalgamation of Nosferatu and Dracula. And the opening sequence where he's showing the mummies, that's fantastic. The rest of it gets kind of like I appreciated the fact that, like, you know, like as opposed to being like super stylized like Coppola's Dracula, like it's very like earthy and very like, you know, realistic. But I don't know, the acting in lots of Herzog's movies just like throws me for a loop because it's so like, I don't know, it's like he's imagining that like every single character is like, you know, like acting like to the ether, or, you know, like they're you know, doing their dialogue to the stars or whatever Herzog would say. And it's like, there's no, like, there's nothing natural about any of it. And that's just, you know, I don't know. It's like, anyway. So after watching that, I decided to rewatch the Dreyer film Vampire, which went up for me. Because, like, the runtime is great. It's only 79 minutes. And the special effects in this freaking movie are insane. Like, there's a part where, like, the main guy is, like, watching, like, he's watching this, like, shadow, like, crawl through a window. And, like, you really think, like, that the shadow is, like, coming towards you. And then, like there's a soldier who's, like, sitting on a bench. And then, like, his shadow comes and, like, walks over and sits on the other side of the bench. And, like, it's exactly where it should be. Like, it's insane.
Sounds killer.
Yes. I would highly recommend watching it if you haven't yet.
I've had it on DVD for like 20 years. I haven't watched it yet.
Gotta get on that, bud.
Yeah, I should. I really
but yeah. Should. And I started rewatching Coppola's Dracula, but I hadn't gotten very far in it before I just, you know, started watching other stuff.
Totally.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to say I watched Horizon, An American Saga, Chapter 1. This is the new Kevin Costner Western. It's 3 hours long. It's the first of four parts. It's the one that famously bombed at the box office, and then they immediately took the second one. They shelved it from coming out. It was supposed to come out this coming month, August, I think the 16th. And now it's shelved. They actually just announced today that it's going to play at Venice as the last film out of competition. So we'll see. They wanted. They said they wanted this to get more play on streaming before they play the second one to people because, you know, nobody went to see this one. I honestly just feel like I liked Horizon a lot, and I feel like it's just not a movie that is for almost anyone these days. Like, it's a 3-hour epic Western, like a very classical Western, John Ford style sort of thing. And not, I don't know who the audience is for that outside of boomers, and boomers aren't going to the theater. Like, there's no way to get a boomer in the theater. So if Kevin Costner in an old school Western cannot get a boomer in the theater, then it's done, you know? Yeah. So I don't see them releasing chapters 2, 3, and 4 in cinemas, maybe like for awards consideration, but like not in a serious way, not in a widespread way. But I don't know. I could be wrong. I have been before. But I like this movie. I think it's really well sort of executed. And even though certainly problematic from certain perspectives, you could certainly read this as very racist against Native Americans. But then there's also, like, you know, the counter argument to that would be, I guess, you know, that stuff like what happens in this, how the Native Americans behave in this film, stuff like that did happen. So, you know, I don't know. But outside of that, I think it's just a very well executed Western, classic Western. And I enjoyed it. And a lot of, like, an epic scope, a lot of production value. Performances were all pretty good, with maybe the exception of Luke Wilson is in this, and he plays a wagon train master, like a wagon master, and he's weird. Like, just seeing him try to be tough is bizarre. You're trying to be like a tough guy, you know, and it's just like, you're Luke Wilson.
Yeah, I mean,
that voice, you know, I can't buy it. And he's got no facial hair still. It's just weird. But other than that, everybody's pretty good. Michael Rooker's in this, which is cool to see him. Mm-hmm. Giovanni Ribisi shows up for a second.
Nice.
Yeah, I liked it.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of great the Native American performances are quite good. This guy Tatanka Means and Owen Kroshu, who played like the sort of young Indian who doesn't like the fact that white settlers are coming to their land and trying to make a town, this town of Horizon. And then the chief who is, you know, doesn't want more bloodshed, that sort of thing. And they have a falling out and split the tribe, but really
interesting,
like solid, cool. It's cool that I think it's interesting to see that like Costner is used, like they're a part of the story. You know what I mean? They're not just nameless. That's the part where you might make the argument where it's like, okay, this is better than normal because they're not just nameless, faceless brown people attacking white people. And so they're obviously evil. It shows their rationale for it. And it has scenes where it's just Native Americans discussing their situation and their relationships with each other too. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
How many parts did you say there were going
to
be?
Four, supposed to be. They've already filmed two.
Okay, that was going to be my next question.
Yeah, I think Venice is happening relatively soon. Before the end of the year, for sure. August, yeah, it's happening in August, so okay. End of August. So that's done. I don't know about three and four. I think they're probably waiting to see how two is received before they green light three and four, although he is self-financing a lot of it himself, so I don't know. But you only have so much money, you know? Kevin Costner, yeah. I'm sure he's rich, but I don't know how rich, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't have a wine company to, you know, boost him up.
Exactly. Yeah, did I tell you guys that he was on Coppola was on Stern talking about his winery, and he was making a film then. I think he was on there talking about Twixt, and he was saying that, and they were asking him like, "Do you just have so much money from making The Godfather and stuff?" And he goes, "No, not really, because I don't touch any of that money. That money just like sitting, like those residuals come in." And he goes, "I can do whatever I want because of the winery. The winery makes like $1 billion a year. I can just like, I have a private jet. I can fly anywhere in the world I need to go to scout locations or whatever." And he talks about how the winery is essentially like a movie production studio. It like pays for everything.
Nice. So,
I thought that was interesting. Yeah. I didn't realize it was that successful. So,
yeah, but, I mean,
yeah, pretty cool.
Earlier today, I had an event happen.
Mm.
I was feeding my child, giving my 5-week-old daughter Eloise a bottle. I was giving her a bottle, heard a poop sound, and she's sitting on my lap. That's fine. Yeah, poop into a diaper, normal.
Sure.
Except that the poop did not stay in the diaper, and I had an event that I called. I was shit rivered, right? Just all of a sudden, there's a river of infant shit running down my leg. It's on my shirt. It's on the sofa. So I apologize for my absence just now. But my wife also just got shit rivered downstairs.
Oh, no.
And she was playing with fire, though. She said that was the third poop in that diaper. And I was like, "Sarah, clearly there's a volume issue happening. You can't sit on it." Like when I opened that diaper earlier, it's like there was like a little splash of poop in the diaper, but it's like the poop hit the diaper and just jettisoned out like a ricochet.
Oh,
whew. Anyway, shit river. Sorry about that. I just don't know what movie to talk about, so I'm just vamping with poop talk. Okay, so I'll do a twofer here of movies that have interesting elements, but ultimately don't work. I did. I watched In a Violent Nature, which was one of those, you know, minor indie horror hits earlier this year, kind of like early summer, late spring. And the idea of In a Violent Nature is that it's a slasher movie, but for 90% of it, you are following the killer, like literally following him. The camera is following him as he walks, as though it's like a third person video game.
Nice.
And I thought this was an interesting idea. There's like a lot of time spent just wandering. And I like the idea of like him hearing like conversations from people who are elsewhere in the woods stuff, except that those conversations are often just like way too expository. It's like, come on, give me some like actual dialogue here. And like some of these kills are like, they're fucking gross and gnarly. And in terms of it being like a horror movie, like a slasher movie, I think it's effective for that, but entirely too long and never gets past like the interesting idea. But yeah, just interesting idea. And then the night before I watched Memory, I watched Knox Goes Away, which is Michael Keaton's directorial debut, which also is about
not his debut.
Not his director. No.
Sorry. He directed some movie back in like 2002 or something called A Merry Gentleman or something like that.
Okay, shit.
I talked about this when I talked about Knox Goes Away.
You know, I forgot.
You weren't listening. I'm sorry. Of course, you don't listen to my review. So
it was a long. It was like 3 months ago.
Just kidding.
Or more. But yeah, and I did know that you talked about this, so I wasn't going to spend much time on it. I really just wanted to mention it because of the dementia angle. But I thought this movie is like the opposite of Memory, where you know Michel Franco can take like what sounds like maybe a boring premise and put some really interesting characters and at least introduce some interesting questions, even if he doesn't answer them or interrogate them. Knox Goes Away has like a really interesting premise, and I think it just totally wastes it. And is like, it also is not super interested in the dementia part of it and the family dynamics that are introduced. It's like, it ultimately ends up being like a super predictable movie. It's like Knox comes up with a plan and that plan goes off without a hitch. And like, there's like one exciting scene that you like, they kind of telegraph is coming. And it's just, yeah, like everything just kind of works out. It's not interesting. But I did like Michael Keaton in the role.
Now you have to watch Martin Campbell's Memory from 2022 about Liam Neeson as a hitman with dementia.
Martin Campbell's a great filmmaker. Let's go. Just kidding.
Hey,
he has been
arguably better than Michael Keaton. I mean, yeah.
Hey, he did GoldenEye. So come on.
That's true. He has good movies.
He did Casino Royale. Better than GoldenEye, so
I'll watch. I mean, what's it called? Is it just called Memory also?
Yeah, it's just called Memory. It's horrible, but I mean it's way worse than Knox Goes Away.
I'm gonna check it out.
By all means, check it out. Yeah. This is like the death gasp of Liam Neeson's action career. You know?
Which is, I mean, that's okay. Like
I'm fine with it too, but it's really bad.
Like Liam Neeson used to be able to like act. Can someone give him like a real job? Or does he not want those? Like, does he just want to do like stupid action stuff? I can't tell.
Scorsese let him act in Silence, you know?
Yeah.
He was great. He was great. He's like, did fine in that. Jared just had a technical error. Oh, now he's out again.
Wow.
Kevin, you want to continue?
Yeah, so I'll just wrap up. I finally watched Challengers.
Mm-hmm.
Which I enjoyed quite a bit. I had seen a bunch of interviews with Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, and they were talking about the score and this, that, and the other. And I will say, like, it is insane. And I very much enjoyed it.
It's aggressive.
It is.
It's not even the score. I feel like it's not even the score itself that's aggressive. It's just the way that it's used in the film. Like how loud it is during certain scenes, how it comes out of nowhere in certain scenes.
Yeah. Like,
but I think that all really works for what the film's going for, the energy and everything. So.
Yeah, I would agree. Cause like there's a lot of stuff in
Challengers,
there.
Challengers, JR.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause there's a lot of stuff in there that would like fit pretty comfortably in a Mortal Kombat movie.
<That's true. laughs> Anyway. Well, it is about a duel of sorts.
Indeed. And, yeah. Yeah, and so, like, I don't remember how much you guys talked about it, but yeah, like, you know, like from the trailer, I thought it was going to be, you know, some love triangle, and then it, you know, it's not that at all. It's you know, Zendaya being just a brutal, relentless, you know, win at all costs, and just, you know, using these two dudes to you know, whatever to accomplish whatever winning means to her. And, you know, anything that she does is about her winning in some way. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like I thought, this is the first thing I'd seen with, Josh O'Connor and Mike, Feist.
Yeah. Feist.
Yeah.
He's in, I think he's in the Bike Riders.
Feist is in the Bike Riders. He's also in, West Side Story.
Yeah.
The remake. Okay.
He's pretty good in that.
He's very good in West Side Story. Yeah. I like him in that.
Yeah. But yeah, I thought, Josh O'Connor was amazing at just being just a despicable, just a dickhead.
He's pretty smarmy. The smile that he gives him when he's eating that banana on the side just real asshole.
Yeah. It's a total douchebag. And on the other side of that, Mike, as, you know, Art Donaldson, like, I really his just inherent good nature. Mm-hmm. I never thought it was I never thought it was a front. I never thought he was his character was posturing in any way. Yeah, so far, this is my favorite Guadagnino movie.
Whoa.
Sorry, you know.
I can't go there with you, kidding. But it is good.
No, I know you're a... Yeah, you're a Call Me By Your Name guy.
And Bones and All. I think they're both fives. They're both excellent. I don't know.
Yeah, I would go Bones and All. I like Chargers.
Okay.
Yeah, can we talk the ending real quick?
Yes. Oh, sure, yeah. Spoilers for the ending of Challengers.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, so, you know, you're talking like she wants to win, like, whatever cost. And I think that's something that annoyed me so much about the ending. And one of the most popular reviews on Letterboxd kind of gets to this same point. Mm-hmm. She's like, she just wants to see some good fucking tennis. And like the ending, like, I guess there's like an ambiguous nature to it. But I was definitely like, the way she just like, is, what did she say? Like, let's go or whatever.
The end? Yeah. Yeah. She's like, let's go. She says, come on. Let's go.
Oh, yeah. It's like, it really is like a moment where it's like, oh, the action is the juice.
Yeah. And
it's like, does she care about someone winning, or is she just like this just kind of gets her going?
See, I didn't feel that way. I felt like it was like the, I love the ending. I love the ending. Okay. It's so,
I like the ending.
It's so out of control. Like, it's just so not what you would see in one of these movies, like a sports movie. If this is a sport, you call it a sports movie. But anyway, it's like, I feel like the come on, which is a callback, you know, to earlier in the film when she says come on the court, and Feist talks to her about that when they first meet. And it just feels like it's a moment of extreme elation, you know, at the idea that these two, that this friendship is going to come back together. Like, everything's worked out despite...
I don't know if the friendship's coming back.
I do. I mean, that's
they're going to be friends again?
Why do they embrace? They embrace and laugh and cry. Like, they're... Yeah, of course. Are you kidding? Of course.
You think, like, when this is over, he's going to be like, you fucked my wife. Maybe. You certainly say that you fucked my wife. We're friends again.
Do you think that they actually give a shit about that?
They honestly
make out with each other at one point. I mean, they're ready to fuck each other. There's so much sexual tension between the two of them at every point in the film. Even when they hate each other, there's sexual tension between them. You know, he's referencing, get your dick out of my face. Like stuff like that. It's like, I mean, who says that? You know what I mean? Like, they obviously are into one another, which is fine. you know, it's fine if they don't want to fully express that or whatever. I don't, you know, for whatever reason. But I feel like, or maybe, you know what? I just thought of something. Maybe her whole thing is she knows they're sexually frustrated and gay. And she's like, at the end, she's like, thank you. This is what I've been waiting for this entire time. Now they're going to realize that they actually love each other. They don't love me. They love each other. You know, and there was just displaced rivalry, sexual frustration when they were going after me. They really wanted to be with each other, and now they'll be with each other. Come on, right?
I disagree, but I totally see where you're coming from.
And the point is that it's open, right? It's just like you could
yes
read whatever you want into it, which normally I hate, but I think it's kind of I really like it. I don't know. I felt like it was a good like powerful ending, and I like the callback, and I love the callback also earlier in the tennis match of the putting the ball in the crook of the racket to reveal that he's slept with her.
Yeah.
And his reaction to that when he says fuck off. I love that. I rewatched this also, by the way. I rewatched this like a week or two ago. And yeah, it's just great. I don't know. It's really, really good. And it's like better than I thought it was gonna be. Even though I love Guadagnino, but I was like, he might stumble with this one because it's not at all like things that he's directed in the past that I've liked. But it's good.
Yeah. And I like how the, you know, what other like movie or like TV show deals with these sorts of relationship dynamics?
Right.
Like, I can't think of any.
No, there are none.
Yeah.
I mean, there are definitely like love triangles are a thing, but it's like it's not really a love triangle, right? It's like a
no. Yeah.
It's not as if, well, Faced is sort of pining for her while she's with him. But again, I feel like you could read that either way. You could read that like he's jealous of him for being with her, or he's jealous of her for being with him. You know what I mean? You could literally read it either way.
You just reminded me of that Seinfeld episode with the, you know, the one with Keith Hernandez. You know, like, wait a second. You jealous of him or you jealous of me?
Exactly.
Yeah, and then like later on, like, before you were jealous of him. Before you were jealous of me. Now you're jealous of him. Oh, I'm jealous of everybody.
Right. Exactly. It is like that. You know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
All right.
No, I'm done.
Is it okay? You're totally done.
Yeah, I'm totally done.
Okay, then I'm gonna cut a couple out because I watched some crap last night that I don't need to talk about.
800 movies left. I'm just kidding. Well, I don't.
I watched The Gambler last night, the 2014 movie with Mark Wahlberg, which was better than I thought it would be. Okay. And it was actually shot by Greg Fraser, who shot Dune, won the Oscar for Dune, and it looks really good. But I mean, it's decent. I put it on my deep dive list just in case. And then I watched The Runner right after it, which is another like compulsive gambler movie from the late 90s, and it's atrociously bad. But I'll talk about Long Legs real quick. Long Legs is the recent horror movie from Osgood Perkins that's been everybody's been talking about this one.
Oh, little baby.
Jared's babies on cam. Long Legs is the Micah Monroe, Nicolas Cage movie about the FBI agent who is trying to solve murders from a serial killer who is leaving notes and stuff. Very, very, very cliched stuff. And overall, I would say it's definitely like homaging a lot of different types of serial killer movies, which is like in and of itself kind of a letdown. It's sort of a disappointing, you know, to like just see a movie in 2024 that's about a serial killer and a cop chasing a serial killer, and it's not doing that much new stuff with it. But Nicolas Cage is a lot of fun in it, and genuinely creepy at times not creepy at all, at times goofy and like trying to be funny, and is funny. But at other times, some of the stuff is effective. Some of the ways that Osgood Perkins chooses to shoot Nicolas Cage is quite effective and creepy. In particular, just the opening scene, which is like a 2-minute scene, and it is disturbing. but overall, I couldn't I don't hate this movie, but I couldn't recommend it. Like, it's not, there's nothing special going on, in my opinion. And a lot of people will disagree. Our good friend Park from the early days, he's seen this. I think he's logged it like 6 times already. He's out of his mind, in love with it.
Even though, man,
sick.
He's still only giving it a 4.5, so I don't know. But
is he trying to juice to get it to a 5?
I think so. He's literally got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 reviews. He says he's cutting himself off now on the 5th review, waiting for the 4K release.
Sure, you are.
Does it look better then?
I guess. He saw it. He literally saw it twice in the same night, apparently.
Oh my God.
I can't do it. His first review was 4, and then he went to a 4.5 on every subsequent review. So, yeah, but you know, Park is a, that's the kind of person Park is. He's a very, very,
he's an individual.
Yeah, very intense and very committed to a narrative. So,
yeah,
you know, this is his hill to die on, long legs.
Yeah. Well, until he finally is able to see, you know,
Anora.
Yes, or, that.
That's gonna be dude, bad.
He's
for
gonna
him.
Probably log that like 78 times in a row.
He's gonna fall in love with that girl who's in it.
Oh yeah, he'll be stalking her Instagram and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Well, I hope not. I hope he.
It's not implicate your friend in any crimes or anything.
No, not stalk, but he was definitely like, he was all over what's her face from the Florida Project. Like, he was,
yeah, so he was
obsessed with her.
The child?
Oh, the lady, the child's mother.
The mom. The actor
played the mother.
Right, well, that's a relief.
Not that she, no.
he was kidding, Park, in case you listen. Sorry about that.
Yeah. Anyway, that's one leg.
Cool. I'm going to, like, I'll just mention these before talking about a real movie. I watched 4, like, movies that I think are really good from 2024. And, of course, movies that are really good, yeah, I don't have much to say or bitch about. So, you know, I think you guys should just go watch them. I watched The Beast, Bertrand Bonello's film starring What's-Her-Face. And
Lea Seydoux.
That is now
John's on favorite woman in the world.
Criterion Channel.
It's beautiful. Isn't it on Mubi also? Or no?
I haven't seen it on Mubi. I
thought it was a Mubi release. Is that not right?
No, it's Janice.
Oh, was it? Okay. I'm wrong.
But it's like, you know, 3 different timelines. It's really kind of 2 and a framing narrative. But definitely some very interesting stuff happening. Recommend. It's a little long. I saw the TV Glow, which you know, I know is another sort of like horror adjacent movie that was getting a lot of press earlier in the year. It definitely worked for me. There's a like 90s TV nostalgia element. There's Lynchian stuff. I'm guessing, I know, John, you said you started it and couldn't finish it. I'm guessing that you would hate it if you watched all the way through. I think the metaphor at the center is sometimes a little obvious, but still emotionally effective by the end. I watched Evil Does Not Exist, which is the new movie from the guy who did Drive My Car. A much shorter film, also a very strange film. It is beautiful. It has the best score I've heard this year. Because I don't count the next movie I watched as a score. I watched Ryuichi Sakamoto Opus, which is like his sort of like final concert film. It's just like a set. It's him, black and white photography, playing the piano. It's gorgeous. The music is amazing. You know, I'm not going to tell you it's like a great film, though it is, again, beautiful. But if you like his music, you should definitely check it out. And then the important thing I watched is fucking Twister. I saw Twister for the first time since I was, I think, in high school. Twister is a movie I was too scared to watch when it came out. I went to my friend's sleepover birthday party, and everyone watched Twister and Congo. I went into another room with his sister and watched That Darn Cat and something else. Twister's too scary, which is like so hilarious now because Twister is like a disaster movie where like no one fucking dies. It's like there's no danger except for two people at the end. They die in the dumbest way possible. And I get like people seem to like Twister because it's got you know, Helen Hunt and Bill Paxton and their chemistry, and then like the team of food. Yeah. The team that surrounds these characters is memorable and has like every just like notable, not every, it's got a bunch of notable 90s character actors.
Mm.
And that part is cool. And I liked some of them sometimes. But ultimately, like, this is like a silly, silly, silly fucking movie. With like no credible emotional stakes to me. And, you know, they did Cary Elwes dirty, I think. In this and like, there's no. Like, they try to make him an antagonist because it's like he's in it for the money, but then they just have Cary Elwes sit in the passenger seat of a vehicle looking at a map, constantly just driving. And sometimes they'll be like, oh, they're going this way. Should we go that way? And he'll be like, yes. Or he'll say, no. That's it.
No emotional stakes, you say?
Not really. I think that's the whole Jamie Gertter stuff was. And they did her dirty too with that goddamn haircut.
Indeed.
That's a beautiful woman.
She's gorgeous. She is gorgeous.
Hair was awful. Oof. But
with her hair. She looks
great. Initially when they introduce her and like they say Paxton's like a you know, a meteorologist working for a news network, I think. I was like, oh, she must be like the news anchor. She's got fucking news anchor. It's like a psychologist.
What about the scene when Helen Hunt breaks down and she says, "You never seen it come from skip one house and skip the next house and then land on you," or whatever she says, and then he's like, "Is that what you think happened?" You know, like I always remember getting emotional from that scene. That's pretty good.
No, well, and maybe this is like a
it took her dad.
It did take her dad. She's the only one who's seen a Category 5.
That's right, F5.
F5,
yeah. Category 5 is working, sorry. yeah, look, that's all fine. This movie was entertaining throughout. I think this is a case of I missed the boat. I wish that I had watched this when I could have fallen in love with it instead of watching That Darn Cat.
Are you... And this is fully in preparation to watch Twisters. You're actually going to waste time and watch Twisters.
That's the thing, man. Probably not. Like, I don't know. I'm certainly not going to a theater to see it. And I'm, yeah, all of my
4DX or whatever. You know.
I've been doing a few like bits of preparation for movies that I'm definitely not going to a theater to see, which is, you know, a weird choice. I kind of feel like I'm catching up. Like, I knew I'd seen Twister before, but I kind of just wanted to see if I could relive it.
Right.
Yeah.
I've seen Twister so many times that I know I don't ever need to see it again.
Food. All these people just died. Let's go get food.
Right. I just remember, I wore the VHS out of this whenever in like early 2000s when I was in high school. I used to watch this shit like every afternoon. I would watch Twister and Roadhouse nonstop until I saw Dog Day Afternoon. And then that became my go-to. I would watch Dog Day Afternoon like all the fucking time. It was crazy.
You're so cultured.
I was really weird. It was really, that's like the weird, like you wouldn't think that movie would be like a good rewatch all the time, but it was, I probably seen it 30 times. Like,
I mean, we went through a phase in high school. I never did Dog Day Afternoon like that, but when we got, like, my friends and I, when we got to Dog Day Afternoon, we loved it, and it was on. Yeah. Like, we rented it from Blockbuster, and we did not return it after watching it once.
I had the same thing with From Dusk Till Dawn. I watched From Dusk Till Dawn. I remember I watched it, I was getting ready to watch it a third time through in the same day, and my mom stopped me. She's like, "You can't watch it again." So, you know, what are you going to do? Okay, well, I think that I want to say that since he just went through four good ones, that the only one he's got left is Aggro Drift, the one he doesn't like. So,
no, I've got Daredevil and Elektra left.
Okay. Well, I'm going to talk Aggro Drift, which is Harmony Korine's newest film. And it feels like he's back, baby. He's got another one coming, which I'm excited about. It's called Baby Invasion. It's scored by Burial, which is exciting.
That's cool.
I liked Aggro Drift, and I'll explain why, because I feel like an explanation is needed.
It certainly is.
I understand exactly why JR did not like this movie and why others would not like this film.
JR doesn't play video games.
I don't think. Well, I mean,
JR doesn't like stupid dialogue that sounds like it's right out of a 2005 video game. They didn't even like. They didn't even try to have dialogue.
Well, because I would say because this movie is not about a story. It's not. It doesn't exist to tell a story. It exists as almost like an experiment, you know. And it just keeps reminding me of Harmony Korine in that one interview. And I want to say it was on that. What's that show that's on the Criterion Channel? That show from like the late 90s and early 2000s where they interview filmmakers and stuff. You know what I'm talking about?
No.
Oh, I think I know what you're talking about. The one with John. What's his face?
I don't. It's got a lot of different. There's like three or four seasons of it on there, and there's like a bunch of different directors they talk to. They talk to like Wes Anderson, and they talk to Tarantino, and they talk to all sorts of different people.
Kevin, are you thinking Fishing with John?
No, there was
not Fishing with John.
Oh shoot, what was it?
It's not. It's not on the Criterion Collection. It's just on their channel. It's just on the channel. It's like a show that was on Sundance Channel or IFC or something.
Yeah, the one I'm thinking of was it was on IFC and like. Like, yeah, they had one with, like Kevin Smith and...
Sure. Exactly.
Like, and I think the same episode might have had, like, the guys from American Movie.
Yes. No, that's exactly what I'm talking about. I think that might be the first episode, in fact. Anyways, it reminds me of... he was on there. Harmony Korine was on there being interviewed, and he talked about how, like, cinema is essentially in its infancy as an art form. Like, it's still a very young art form, and there's a lot of things, like, we haven't seen been done with it, you know? And it feels like, even though people are already repeating themselves a ton, that there's so much more to sort of expand out and get to. And I think a lot of the things that he's doing with this are, like, I don't think everything is successful about this movie. If I did, it would be a five. But I like a lot of what it's laying down. I like the certain aspects of the photography I think are really, really cool. I think it makes for some interesting, almost like probably incidental or accidental shots that just happen to look amazing. I really like the sort of like CG stuff that's going on with the bodies, like all over the skin of the characters. There's like shapes and shit. And stuff. I think that's really cool. I think that's a really interesting idea. Like, this movie, one thing it achieves, and I don't think you can argue with this, is that it definitely feels like otherworldly. It does not feel like it's happening in Miami, which I'm sure is where they film, but like, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't feel real at all.
You're right, but especially like at the beginning where we're first introduced like to the woman. Mm-hmm.
The wife, his wife?
Yes.
Okay.
I just, like, I was gonna, you know, I was like, what's her name?
Bo's wife.
Yeah, sorry. So, like, yeah, there's, it's otherworldly in a way that, like, a lot of it, like, with the narration reminded me of David Lynch, even though, obviously, David Lynch has never, and I don't think would ever, film a movie to look like this. So, like, it's still, I thought, recalled other things in cinema, but you know, I'm not gonna. I'm not saying I'm not gonna shit on him for recalling Lynch for being otherworldly.
No, of course not. I wouldn't say it's wholly original. Like, and I mean, obviously, it's incredibly derivative story wise, and like what it's about is like a very sort of cliched, generic, you know, a hitman who works for the mob or what. I mean, you know what I mean, it's like not a, it's not a crazy story exactly.
It bugs me that like, it just bugs me that like, if you're going to do this visually, why can't you make the story part of it? I mean, I think he wanted it to be a derivative, and I guess I just don't understand. Like, the dialogue in this movie is obviously like intentional, right? When we have,
yes, split screen. That's what it's called.
It's like when he's talking to his boss or his handler, who's just like giving him like the exposition we need for him to go on like his video game mission. Cause like, again, like a lot of this feels like a video game to me. Or at least the sort of like the narrative parts of it do. It's like, it's a choice to make it this wooden and derivative. And I just don't understand why that is the choice with this visual aesthetic.
Well, he might, I don't pretend to know, like, Harmony Korine's got weird taste also. So like he'll outwardly say like, I want the thing to look like a video game. I think video games look amazing and that's so cool. And it's just a really cool aesthetic. And I like, you know what I mean? Like it could be as simple as that. Like, I'm not saying that I'm not saying that what he's doing here is high cinema art because he means it to be high cinema art. I just think he's experimenting with the form and it's successful in a lot of ways for me. I think it's really interesting. I think he's pushing boundaries of like, I mean, just, you know, with visuals mainly. And I'm interested in that. And I look forward to him doing more shit like this. Like I would like, don't get me wrong, I would love for him to make like Julian Donkey Boy again, make something, you know, that's experimental in that way.
But I can't win with him. You know?
Right. You hate everything he's done. Right. So it's like, you know, if he did another Gummo, you wouldn't be happy, right?
No, I would not. One thing I hate about my own opinion of this is like my enjoyment level of this was like a 1-star, right? Like I really, truly was not enjoying it, but like I can't give it a 1-star because like the reason I don't enjoy it is like me putting what I think movie should be onto this movie. And that's obviously not what Harmony Korine wants. And I understand that, but I cannot square it with my brain to let me enjoy this either.
It's almost like it's similar to, and maybe I'm only comparing it because they both sort of weren't released in a lot, like weren't released in a traditional way.
This was like, released on edgelord.com for $15. What are you talking about?
Right. Well, and he toured it to strip clubs. Right. So, just like a very non-traditional release structure. And, it reminds me of, Crispin Glover's films, you know, like the way he won't release his stuff. Very, very hard to find, digital copies of anything. And then, he, you know, tours his films around and his films are very impenetrable and, inscrutable also. So, of course, maybe less experimental than this, though, in a lot of ways. But, I mean, they certainly are, you know, they have stories and they're shot on film and they're just sort of, you know, but there's a lot of weird shit going on. Anyway.
Oh, man.
And both obviously, I agree with you, the Lynch thing. I think Harmony Korine probably is a fan of Lynch's. I don't know that for sure, but I get the feeling that he probably gets something out of his work, and I know that Crispin Glover is a disciple of his. So, but yeah, I don't know. It worked for me, man. I look forward to seeing what's next. That's all. That's all I have to say. I'm just glad he's making shit again. Honestly, like I would rather him make bad stuff even than not be making films. You know. Like I want Lynch to make films again. Lynch comes out with his, there's going to be a huge announcement about something coming up this Friday. And it's a fucking album. Like, I don't want to hear his music. Not interested, dude. It's not even that it's bad. It's just like, I just want to see a film. Like make a film.
Him and John Carpenter.
Yeah.
These music guys. You know. These
boomers who think they're rock stars. Yeah. Time to move on, guys.
Yeah. I mean, I did see John Carpenter was on Everybody's in L.A. with John Mulaney.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And, I mean, he's like, he just seems like a chill guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's seems to be just enjoying his life making music. And, you know, it's like he's old. Probably doesn't want the stress of making a film.
He's a gamer. He loves games. He plays NBA 2K.
I mean, you know, like, you guys are the majority now. You know, I get it. You'll the world plays video games, and one day I'll just have to accept that video games are fun.
Okay,
I don't like playing them.
I do game. I like video games. I have a PC. I have a PS5. I play video games. I am not one of these people for whom video games are some sort of art form that it's like that should be respected on the level of literature and film. Video games are purely entertainment for me. I like playing them. They're a good pastime. I can understand why some are respected others better than others. But like when there's a game that's like super heady and like not fun to play, like that's not cool to me. Like I'm looking for a game that's fun, you know? So I don't give a shit about the argument of like Hideo Kojima being a genius because he makes, you know, Death Stranding and it's a fucking walking simulator. You know?
Is he Ico in Shadow of the Colossus?
I don't know. Is he? He did Metal Gear Solid.
Okay. Yeah. I don't think so.
I don't know who did Ico in Shadow of the Colossus.
I was rearranging my Blu-rays physical media today, and just I've got like 5 PlayStation 2 and 3 games that are with my DVDs for some reason. One of them is I was like, oh, I bought this game for PS3, like the remake or the remastered Ico Shadow of the Colossus. I should play them one day.
Shadow of the Colossus rocks, dude.
I believe it. I wanted very badly to play it.
You could play Shadow of the Colossus on your MacBook with an emulator. Runs fine.
My MacBook is...
Oh, how old is your MacBook?
Almost 12 years old.
Okay, yeah, never mind. It would not run on your MacBook. But mine struggles at certain points. If you're in like these super open spaces, it starts to like the lag. But
I've got like this new, like my work computer that I'm on right now is a...
there you go.
Like a new Surface, but it's a work computer. I don't know what emulators are like.
I mean...
I haven't played an emulator since they were... emulating Nintendo games.
It's extremely easy to just download like a DuckStation or something, and emulators are like ROMs are free. ROMs are the games. They're everywhere.
I believe it. I mean, just like I don't know if it's gonna slow down my computer. You know, I still live in that
it will slow it down while you're playing the game.
I live in that early 2000s sphere of viruses, you know, like the
I wouldn't worry about that. I would more be worried about don't download porn on your work computer. I would worry more about I'd be more worried about your just people being able to monitor what you're doing on your computer and not being happy with that. But
well, I wouldn't do it at work. I don't have time.
But on your work computer though, I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't do it on your computer. I would not encourage that.
No.
Anyway, next episode is the next one. It's Kevin's pick.
Yeah.
Kevin, what are we watching?
We're watching The Favorite from 2018, directed by Yorgos Lanthimos. Haven't seen it since the theater. I need to watch this again, and I need a reason to... get me to do it for some
reason. I'm in, bro. I'm in.
I think I'm the same. I don't think I've seen this since the theater.
Neither have I. And I should rewatch this also because I remember loving it.
Oh, yeah. It was a 6 out of 5 when I saw it in the theater.
Nice. All right. So we're going to rewatch The Favorite and talk about that.
With a U.
With a U, right? From Yorgos Lanthimos. And Kevin will be watching... My Winnipeg?
Yes.
And until next time, visit our website, filmyak.castos.com. Email us at filmyakpodcast@gmail.com. You can like and subscribe to us on all of the podcast platforms, on Instagram, etc., etc., etc. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Batman wouldn't want a pit stop, right?
No.
Red meat. We crave sustenance.
Guys, we are not invading my aunt.
Food.
Food.
Hey, we're absolutely not going.